afternoon, and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon, taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible or the Christian faith, I'd be glad to hear from you. If you disagree with the host, that's me, about anything, feel free to call and disagree on the air. We'll be glad to talk to you about that. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. I am broadcasting this week from Salem, Oregon. I'm teaching at the Youth with a Mission base in Salem. Some of you in Oregon know where that is. I'm broadcasting from the base, hopefully it'll all go well. Looks like we've got a strong internet signal here, which is what usually is required for me to do the program remote. But I'm in a place where people may be coming and going. I don't have a private spot. So if people come in, they may make noise. There may be some background noise here. I'm not in a studio. I'm in a cafe, which at the moment doesn't have much activity going on. But in the next hour, who can say? I'm just letting you know. While I'm in Oregon, I'm speaking at a variety of places. Tomorrow night, I'll be speaking in Lebanon, Oregon. And on Wednesday night, I'll be speaking in Milwaukee, Oregon. Friday night, I'm speaking... Thursday night, I'm speaking in Estacada. Friday night, I'm speaking in Albany. Saturday in Portland. So I'm all over the place. Sunday, I'm going to be speaking at a church in the morning in Rockaway Beach. And Sunday night, I'll be speaking in Salem at a winery. And I'll be speaking at that same winery Monday night in Salem. So I'm here through a week from today, and I'm in various places, mostly different places each night, as well as every morning I'm speaking for Youth with a Mission in Salem. I've got a busy week, as typically is the case when I travel, but I just want you to be aware, if you are in Oregon, some of these locations may be accessible to you, and I welcome you to join us if you want to come. If you want to know the place and time for each meeting, they are listed at our website. The website is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Once you get to the website, you'll want to click on the box that says Announcements. And then you'll find the time and place of each of these gatherings this week. Our lines are full at the moment, so we're going to go directly to talk to the callers. And our first caller today is Carl from La Mesa, California. Carl, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello, Steve. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, sir.
Okay. I'm trying to write a tract based on your analogy of the man who jumped ship. You know, he leaves the ship where Satan is the captain and gets on board the ship where Christ is the captain. I'm wondering, in that analogy, how do I incorporate the atonement and the fact that we're all sinners, i.e., you know, the new captain could say, why should I let you on board? Where's your ticket? Where's your paper? Or something like that. You know, can you help me with that a little bit?
Well, you know, when you're writing an analogy, it's like a parable, not everything usually is included in a parable. You know, none of Jesus' parables told the whole story by itself. I drew a comic tract back in the 70s that was kind of an analogy for the gospel, but it didn't have everything in the story itself. So at the end, I had an explanation. You know, after the story was over, I explained it. So I included things that couldn't be included in the analogy. So I guess that's what I have to say. It may be that you'll think of something that goes right into the story that parallels with the atonement. If it doesn't, you can include that part in a, you know, in explanation at the end. You'll have to use your imagination about that.
Okay. All right, then. Well, thank you very much.
Okay, Carl. Good talking to you, brother. Thanks for calling. We're going to talk to Dane in Pennsylvania. Dane hasn't called us for a while, but he's been calling for a long time. Hi, Dane. Welcome.
Hey, Steve, thank you. Yeah, it's been a while since I called, but I do get to listen fairly frequently, so I appreciate that. My question is out of Romans chapter 8, and my question is to do with Paul's use of Psalms, Psalm 44, he's making a point, it seems, that, you know, who can separate us from the love of Christ, tribulation, distress, persecution, lists all these things. And then he quotes, as it is written. And you might think that he's going to, or at least I might think, that he's going to quote a passage like maybe Psalm 139 or something, that no matter where we go, we can't be separated from God. Mm-hmm. But he always loses me with his quote. I don't know what point he's trying to make there, and I wonder if you can help me out with that.
Well, of course, he asked the question, what shall separate us from the love of Christ? Shall tribulation or distress or persecution or famine or nakedness or peril or sword? I think maybe he's addressing the issue that some people, once things are going badly for them, when they're suffering loss or persecution, or they go to jail, it may be for their faith that they do so. But still, the fact that these circumstances happen make you wonder, am I separated from Christ? He says, no, none of those things will separate us. And he says, as it is written, and there, of course, he quotes from the Psalm, where it says, for your sake, we are killed all the day long. We are counted as sheep for the slaughter. In other words, David is talking about the fact that, or maybe it was not David. I am not looking at the Psalm right now. It could be the sons of Korah or somebody. But the psalmist is saying, we're suffering. You know, we're being slaughtered. We're being persecuted. But he does not assume that that means that he's separated from the love of God. He says, no, this is for your sake. I think the for your sake is the functional phrase that got Paul to quote it. Because, of course, people in the Old Testament who were faithful to God also were persecuted, as Christians have been. And he says, yeah, this is for God's sake. It's not an evidence that God is separated from us. It's happening because of our loyalty to God. It's happening because we belong to God. It's for him and for his sake that it's happening. So I think that that's what Paul's emphasizing by the quotation of that psalm, that, you know, we Christians also may be slaughtered. Sometimes they have been. We haven't. In America, that sounds a little, I don't know, melodramatic to talk about us being slaughtered. Although, frankly, Charlie Kirk was killed, and he may be the first of many. We don't know. But for the most part, we Americans have not known this phenomenon of being slaughtered for our faith. But Christians all over the world and throughout history have. And so did righteous Jews, especially in foreign lands. One of the famous cases we all know about is the Holocaust in our modern times. But in biblical times, Old Testament times, they suffered these things too. But they saw themselves as suffering them not because God had forsaken them, but because of their closeness to God, because of their attachment to God, not because of separation from God. And I think Paul's saying it's just like what the psalmist said. You know, he's been slaughtered, they're being picked off, they're being persecuted, but it's for God's sake. It's not some kind of evidence that God and they have parted company.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. I follow what you're saying. Okay, yes. I don't know how I missed that.
Well, I'm not sure. I'm not even sure I'm right, but that's how I've taken it.
Yeah, well, it makes sense. I mean, I follow what you were saying, and that makes perfect sense along those lines. So, yeah, well, I appreciate that very much.
All right, Dean. God bless you. Good to talk to you.
All right. Take a prayer, brother. All right, bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Okay, our next caller is Tina from Surrey, British Columbia. Hi, Tina. Welcome.
Hi. I just wanted to know, is gluttony a sin? And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Yes. Thank you for your call. Is gluttony a sin? Well, if I say gluttony is a sin, the next question is how much can you eat before you are guilty of gluttony? The Bible does not talk as if obesity is a sin, though it certainly is no ideal. Obesity, first of all, is not a healthy thing, so it's not a good stewardship of your health and your body, and we are stewards of our health and our body. And we have to answer for how we took care of the things God gave us and so forth. So if you eat to the point where you're morbidly obese, for example, you're not going to be healthy, and you don't have to eat like that. So it's an unnecessary waste of years of your life, probably, or at least of functionality, and that's a bad stewardship. Now, the Bible does not say it's wrong to be fat, and I don't know exactly how obese, how fat you can get before you're dangerously obese or whatever. But the Old Testament suggested that being fat is, in a sense, a good thing. That it means that God is prospering you and you're eating well and so forth. And it says that the person who seeks God will delight himself in fatness and so forth. However, of course, that's just a generic thing saying that God takes care of his people who are faithful to him. It's not advocating getting fat. Gluttony may or may not make you fat. I have to say that I have to watch what I eat these days because my stomach's getting a little much bigger than I want it to be. But I genetically came from a very thin family, tall and thin. And until I was 35, I was 6'4" and I weighed 145 pounds. That's literal, 145 pounds at 6'4". So you can see I was really, really skinny. But I ate a lot. I could have been a glutton. No one would know it because no matter what I ate, it just didn't show it. It went away. It burned off. I guess my metabolism was that way. Now, my metabolism changed when I was in my 30s, and now I can't do that without getting fat. So I have to watch my diet. But the point I want to make is a person could be a glutton without being fat. I mean, I could have eaten any kind of thing that a glutton would eat, and it wouldn't show on me in those years. And so you can't just say, well, a fat person is a glutton, and a person who's not fat is not a glutton. So what is gluttony? Gluttony is obviously eating more than you should. In my opinion, everything that God gave us is good and is to be used in the way that he intended it to be used. Food was given to us to nourish our bodies and give us energy and strength, and also to enjoy. There's no question that God wants us to enjoy food because we would have to eat it whether we enjoyed it or not. Our bodies would die without it. And God did not have to give us taste buds that appreciate the flavor of food. He could have just said, eat food or you'll die, and we'd have to do it whether we liked it or not, whether it tasted good or not. The fact that God made something like that enjoyable means he has got no objection to our enjoying it. But we have to, when we steward our health, and I think that's where the issue of gluttony comes in, that I have to say it's a matter of stewardship and a matter of idolatry. When it comes to stewardship, we can say, well, let's just talk about stewardship of money as a parallel. If I have $100 and I really need $50 to cover my bills, then I have $50 I could do something else with. And my stewardship will be reflected and my priorities will be reflected in what I do with that additional $50. I might go eat out, I might go to a movie or buy something I wanted, a luxury. Or I could give it to charity, I could help a poor person out. The choice I make about that is my responsibility before God. There's not a right answer or wrong answer. Like, in that situation, I've got $100, I need 50 of it to live on. The other 50, what am I going to do with that? Well, there's not a right answer to that. I can do very good things. I could give the whole thing to the poor. Or I could spend the whole thing on me. Or I can give part of it to the poor and part of it on me. I mean, and nothing in the Bible tells me what percentages. Stewardship is a matter of personal responsibility. You realize that you've got something that God has given you. He wants you to use it to his advantage the best you can. And yet he's not against you enjoying it, too. So each person with their money has to decide, how much of my money do I feel comfortable giving away or spending on myself, knowing I'm going to stand before God someday and he's going to ask me to give an account for the stewardship. And different people come to different places, and I'm not saying there's a right and a wrong, although there certainly are some choices a person can make that would be very foolish and very displeasing to God. But that doesn't mean that the person who doesn't give 100% to charity is more pleasing or less pleasing to God than the one who does. That's between them and God. And now, okay, we have to steward our bodies too and steward the food we have. And, of course, eating is related to stewarding money also. We've got a complex system of responsibilities and privileges, and we need to live our whole life for the glory of God. It doesn't mean that we can't eat any ice cream after we've had a full meal, but we should recognize that food is primarily given to us for nourishment. And after we've eaten enough to be nourished, then we have to make some serious decisions about how much beyond that can we really justify. Now, I have no trouble justifying having a dessert, though I don't usually have dessert. But if someone serves it, I'll eat it, even though I don't need it. I don't feel guilty. I don't live in guilt or anything like that. On the other hand, I might say I've had enough, and I can do better things with my energy and with my time and with my money than to keep putting more in my stomach after I've had enough to live on. But how much more? See, I do think I can live comfortably with my conscience if I eat somewhat more than I need to survive. Though, how much more? This is a matter of personal conscience before God. But Paul did say in Philippians chapter 3 that there's some people who he said he's weeping over them as he remembers them because their God is their belly and their glory is in their shame. Now, their God is their belly? What does that mean? I remember a preacher when I was younger saying to the audience, he says, you know, how much time do you spend, for example, reading your Bible every day? And how much time do you spend preparing, eating, and cleaning up after meals? And, you know, if it's greatly disproportionate, he said, is it possible that your God is your belly? And you're devoting more of your time and energy and attention to feeding yourself and doing the things related to feeding yourself than to nourishing your spirit. Now, there's not a given amount of food that for every person constitutes being a glutton. But I think that, you know, Paul said, whatsoever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. He said that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I think it's verse 30 or 31. Whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do it all to the glory of God. Now, you know, he's talking there about whether you eat meat sacrificed to idols or not, and especially in situations where doing so might stumble a weaker brother. So he's saying when you choose what you're going to eat, think about the glory of God more than you're thinking about your appetite and your preferences for eating. Of course, we don't have that issue today. No one's eating meat sacrificed to idols that we know of. At least it's not an issue in the modern church. But still, whether you eat, whether you're gluttonous, whether you eat as if your God is your belly or not, that's related to whether you're glorifying God. I don't think, you know, glorifying God is, you know, basically advertising him and to the public and so forth and showing how great he is. And the more we are like Christ, the more we live and exhibit God's values, the more people can see Jesus in us, the more we are glorifying God. But I will say this, I'm at an age now where if I do eat too much, I gain more weight than I want to. And I watch it because I don't want to. Not because I think it's a sin to have extra weight, but especially in our society, people often judge harshly those who have no self-control and advertise the fact that they don't by the size of their bellies or by the amount of food they clearly eat. Now, I realize there are some people, and I really believe this is true. I'm not one of them, but I've talked to people who I think it is true. They say it is, and I trust them. They're fat. Let's face it, they're just fat. And if you look, their whole family is fat. Their parents are fat. Their grandparents are fat. Their siblings are fat. Now, this may be because of bad eating habits the family has indulged in for generations, or it may be, you know, genetically. Just like I could have eaten anything I wanted till I was 35 years old, and I still couldn't put on weight. That was a genetic thing. And there may be people who have the opposite genetic problem. No matter how much they don't eat, they don't seem to get their weight very far down. So, I mean, I don't judge somebody about that if they're carrying extra weight. But when you see someone, you know, who's 300, 400 pounds, you have to say, you know, unless they've got a glandular problem, and that's what people always used to say, I've got a glandular problem. Well, maybe they do, although it's amazing how many of those people, once they severely restrict their diet and start exercising, that glandular problem disappears. But I mean, let's face it, 300-400-pound people are too heavy. I mean, not because there's some number of pounds that's okay or some number of calories per day that's okay to eat. Those things might differ for different people. But because it's obviously excessive, and anyone who looks at somebody that size is thinking, you know, that person has no self-control. That person has no self-respect. That person has no interest in being healthy. They are simply, they're driven by their appetite. Now, if a Christian is that way, if people can look at a Christian and make that conclusion, And by the way, it's fairly safe to make that conclusion when you see something that size. You know, it doesn't glorify God. It doesn't glorify God. And I will tell you this. I once read in an article that preachers, as a profession, preachers are more out of shape physically than any other professionals. Not that I think of preachers as professionals, but that's how the magazine article put it. And let's face it, there's a lot of fat preachers. Some of them may be listening to me, and I don't mean to insult you, but you know it's true. And I will tell you that if you're walking around with a lot of extra fat on your body, that probably you're advertising to everyone who looks at you, whether they say it or not, that you do not have control over your diet, because you probably don't want to be that fat, but you just don't have the self-control to change it. Christians, if you walk in the Spirit, the fruit of the Spirit is self-control. So is gluttony a sin? It is a sin when it's a result of lack of self-control, because you're not walking in the Spirit. If you walk in the Spirit, you'll have self-control. How many pounds overweight can you be and not be sinning? I don't know. I don't think anyone has to set a number there. I'd say if you're walking in self-control, you're not going to be 400 pounds. You know, how much weight should you weigh? I don't know. How about be as healthy as you can? I will never have a perfect body. But I can be as healthy as I can be. And in doing so, I'm taking care of a stewardship that God has given me. I'm not going to live forever. But if I make healthy life choices, I've got a better chance of living longer. And more days of life is more time to serve God. So, and I've never measured my life except in terms of opportunities to serve God. Since I was a teenager, I've never had any other way of measuring my life. How many opportunities do I have to serve God in the next 24 hours or the next 70 years or 80 years? And I think that's, you know, maybe I'm radical about that, but I think everyone should be more like that if they're not. And so gluttony is going to be, there's going to be a sliding scale for the definition of gluttony. But if it turns out that a person is eating a lot more than they need to stay alive, and it's taking up much more of their thoughts and attention and affections than the things of God, then there may be a danger there. There may be a situation where your God is your belly. And so also, of course, it's not glorifying God. Whatever you do, whether you eat or drink, do all to the glory of God. Those would be the thoughts I have. The Bible doesn't talk about gluttony too much. There's one point in the law where a son would be stoned to death because he was an adult son who was a drunkard and a glutton. And that was, you know, he was put to death for that in the law. So, you know, obviously, though you don't read the word gluttony very often in the Bible, similar or principles are definitely in play in many parts of the Bible. And the main thing is, the comparison of what you're doing with food and what you're doing with God, which is more important. If you're several hundred pounds, the whole world knows which is more important to you. And that's not a good testimony, in my opinion. All right, let's take another call. We're going to talk to Dan in Coos Bay, Oregon. I used to live in Bandon, not far from Coos Bay. Hi, Dan. Welcome.
Hi, Steve. Hey, I'm changing this subject entirely, but not, I don't know, 180 degrees, because I want to talk about feet, not starving myself with dieting.
Okay. Yeah.
Anyway, so I've been told that the spring feasts are types of Christ's first coming, and the fall feasts are types of the dispensational view of the future. And I'd like to hear your response to that. And I guess a second question, if you have time, is regarding the atonement for sin mentioned in Ezekiel and how and why they can make a galactic leap from animal sacrifices for atonement, as mentioned, to a memorial of Christ's sacrifice
right
in the future millennium.
Okay. Well, let's talk about the festivals first. For those who have no idea what you're talking about, the Jewish religious calendar had seven festivals or feasts. Some of them were 7 days long, and some were just a single day. But they recurred every calendar year. And there were three of them in the spring and four of them in the fall. And we find that these feasts and the book of Hebrews tells us that this is so, these feasts, they corresponded with spiritual realities. The law really had, they were types and shadows of spiritual truth related to Christ. Now, the three spring feasts were actually fulfilled in the first coming of Christ. Passover, Jesus died at the Passover and was, in fact, a fulfillment of the meaning of the Passover. First fruits was the Sunday after that. Jesus rose from the dead. And then Pentecost was the feast of first harvest. And that was fulfilled when the Spirit was given to the Christians at Pentecost. Now, the fall feasts were separated by those by a few months. And many people think they refer to the end times. And there's another view, too. I'm going to have to take a break at this point. I'll come back to this and finish this thought. You're listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to write to us, the address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website. Everything at the website is free. Or you can donate there, if you wish, at thenarrowpath.com. We have another half hour coming. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
Toward a radically Christian counterculture, as well as hundreds of other stimulating lectures, can be downloaded in MP3 format without charge from the Narrow Path website, www.thenarrowpath.com. There is no charge for anything at the Narrow Path website. Visit us and be amazed at all you've been missing. That web address, www.thenarrowpath.com.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we're live for another half hour taking your calls. Our lines are full right now, so I'm not going to give the phone number out. If we end up having some lines free, I'll give the number out and you can call in. We're on Monday through Friday. If you don't get in today, call tomorrow or the next day. It's not that hard to get through. Sometimes it's hard once the program has begun, and that's like right now. Anyway, the previous half hour ended with a call from Dan in Coos Bay, who's still on the line. And he was asking about the fulfillment of the fall festivals in the Hebrew festal calendar. And I was just saying before we took our break, for those who don't know, now many Christians, of course, know this, but some don't know that the Jewish feasts on the Jewish calendar in the Old Testament corresponded to things related to Christ. And there were seven such feasts, and three of them were in the spring, four of them were in the fall. The three spring feasts, which were Passover, First Fruits, and Pentecost, they were fulfilled in the first coming of Christ in the first century. Now, the fall feasts are separated in the year by several months, and then they're clustered together. You've got Rosh Hashanah, which is the Jewish New Year. You've got the Feast of Trumpets. You've got the Feast of Tabernacles, which is Sukkot, off the top of my head, I'm forgetting the fourth one just because I'm a little distracted here. But these feasts at the end of the year, or the fall of the year, are often thought by Christians to refer to events at the second coming of Christ. You know, when you hear people predicting the date of the second coming, which no one should ever do, it's interesting that almost always the date they expect him to come is during one of these fall feasts. In fact, just a few weeks ago was Rosh Hashanah, and there was a rather silly internet phenomenon that took place. Somebody in Africa said that some kind of an influencer said that he had a revelation that Jesus is going to return and rapture the church at Rosh Hashanah. Well, obviously he didn't, no one who knows anything about the Bible would have thought that he would have, because we don't know the day or the hour, and it's not ours to know. So anyone who takes seriously anyone setting dates about the second coming of Christ, whoever takes that seriously is a very foolish person and a very immature Christian, if they're a Christian at all. But people do it all the time. And when they do it, it's almost always the case that they set the date at the Feast of Trumpets or Rosh Hashanah or one of these festivals at the end of the Jewish calendar year. Because the assumption is, just as Passover and First Fruits and Pentecost represent things at the first coming of Christ. So also the four feasts at the end of the year represent things related to the second coming of Christ. Now, I will say this, that is a possibility. I will not say that can't be true. And the reason I won't say it can't be true is because the Bible doesn't tell us what they do represent. We are told about Pentecost and Passover, but we're not told about what, you know, when the Feast of Tabernacles is fulfilled or the Feast of Trumpets and so forth. And so people have theories, and it seems like most people who talk about this, they're usually dispensationalists, which is, I suppose, neither here nor there, except I don't know if I've ever heard a non-dispensationalist make such predictions, but they believe that the events of those festivals at the end of the calendar year are related to different things. Some place the rapture at a certain point. Some think it's there's tribulation or Jesus coming with the clouds. Different end times things related to the second coming, they connect in their own mind with different parts of the fall festivals. Now, I'm saying they could be right, though I actually suspect they may not be right, but I have to allow that they could be because the Bible doesn't tell us what they represent. The Bible doesn't answer the question. And if the Bible doesn't answer it, I can't. I don't know anything more about it than the Bible tells me. But I will say there is another view. There are those who believe that the fall festivals were fulfilled with the destruction of Israel and the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70, and that nothing looks beyond that in the festival calendar. So you'd have the coming of Christ represented in the spring festivals, and the destruction of Jerusalem, the final destruction of the Jewish nation, and the temple and all that, in the fall festivals. Now, I can't go into that in detail, partly because I'm not even sure it's true. But to my mind, there is seemingly almost at least as good a case for it as for the idea that they're about the end of the world, because the Bible doesn't really answer. What you have to do is take some of the things about the festivals and then try to connect them with certain things about the event you're trying to connect them to and say, well, that makes sense. This is what it means. But no one can say that with certainty that I know of. The idea that they could relate to what happened in 70 AD would be reasonable because these are the festivals of the law. Jesus said he came to fulfill the law and the prophets. And he said that the Roman armies in Luke chapter 21, verses 20 through 23, said the Roman armies coming against Jerusalem would take place so that all that is written may be fulfilled. All that is written presumably means the law and the prophets written in the Old Testament. So Jesus may have suggested that the fulfillment of all the feasts, including the fall festival feasts, that they would be fulfilled in that generation with the destruction of Jerusalem. That's a point to consider. It's also the case that the festal year is related to the law and to the Jewish nation. Nobody other than the Jewish nation was ever commanded to keep these festivals, and yet the Jewish nation came to an end in AD 70. And by the way, Jerusalem did fall in the fall of that year. I think it was in September or October. The Jewish months don't correspond with ours exactly, but in that fall area is the time when Jerusalem did fall to the Romans. So, the fact that the festal calendar, if it's mapping out the fulfillment of God's dealing with Israel, and that the spring feasts talk about the coming of the Messiah to establish the new order, and then the fall feast, the destruction of the old order, that would be to my mind, a possibility, and there are some who think it. Now, I'm not going to rule out a third possibility, but I'm not going to defend it either. Who's to say that the fall festivals weren't fulfilled in the birth of Jesus, and then the spring festivals in the death of Jesus? I'm not saying this is so, but given the Feast of Tabernacles, the Bible says in John 1:14 that Jesus, the Word, was made flesh and tabernacled with us, and we beheld his glory, and so forth. And so, there may be, I'm not going to defend this because I don't advocate it, but there may be some reason to believe the festivals in the fall were fulfilled before the spring ones.
Because after all, fall comes both before and after spring. There's a cycle of the year, depending on where you start. Now, the religious calendar of the Jews begins at Passover, according to Exodus 12. But the civil calendar starts with the Rosh Hashanah, which is in September. So Israel has two calendars. One of them's their civil calendar, one's their religious calendar. One of them starts at Passover. The other begins at Rosh Hashanah in the fall. So, you know, which is really, where are we supposed to start this series here? Do we start in the fall at Rosh Hashanah, or do we start in the spring? So this is all left very unanswered in Scripture. And I suppose if it was essential for us to know, it wouldn't be left unanswered. But it's fascinating. Some people find it more fascinating than I do to try to, you know, put things together. But I'm saying those fall festivals remain ambiguous. And it's not even, to my mind, I couldn't rule out the possibility that the fall festivals refer to things at the birth of Jesus or at the end of the Jewish state and the Jewish calendar, the Jewish temple, all that. Or maybe at the end of the world, but I don't tend to lean toward the dispensational view of them being fulfilled at the end of the world in the second coming of Christ. I think, to my mind, I think there's other possibilities that could be better.
Yeah. Well, I couldn't figure it out for myself, so I thought maybe...
I can't either. I can't either. I appreciate your call, brother. Let's talk to Glenn from Gainesville, Florida. Glenn, welcome.
Hi, Steve. My name is Glenn Barnes, Jr. I was born in Kentucky, but raised in Puerto Rico. And I have to apologize before I start to ask you a question. I think that I was blessed by the Lord, but because at the age of 7 years old, my sister and I went to the mountains in Puerto Rico and saw the Virgin Mary. I know that is the devil's in person. But when I get home, at that age, I went to the Bible that I was having in my closet.
Uh-huh.
And the Lord blessed me to put the Ten Commandments. And he said that you should not lay down in any statue or anything like that.
Mm.
But my question is, three questions in one. This is Genesis chapter 2, verse 1 to 3. Does the heaven and the earth were finished, and all the host of them? And in the seventh day God ended his work, and he handed, and he rested on the seventh day from all his work which he had made. And God blessed the seventh day and sanctified it, because that in that he rested from all his work, and which all the created and made. So if I go to chapter 24 of Matthew, before Jesus left this earth, he said very clearly, be careful that nobody beguile, because in verse, I am a little bit nervous, but I'm just trying to be quick and...
Yeah, please do be quick, because you're a Seventh-day Adventist, aren't you?
I know.
Yeah.
Please, just hear this.
Yeah, it's not as if we haven't heard this thousands of times. Go ahead. Be quick, please.
I know, but... let him...
Okay, why don't we just, instead of reading those passages, why don't you give me your question? What is your question?
Well, the Lord never changed, right?
He doesn't change. His character never changes, correct?
So, Jesus said in chapter 24, I don't remember exactly the verse.
No, but what is your question?
My question is that is in chapter 66 of Isaiah.
No, that's not a question. You're quoting a verse. In Isaiah 66, in Isaiah 66 says, from one Sabbath to the next, and from one new moon to the next, people will come and worship before the Lord. Right. Okay, so I've heard that one quoted by Seventh-day Adventists many times. What is your question
so
for me?
There is three places pretty clearly that the Sabbath is a seventh-day very...
Right, there's no question. There's no question but that the Sabbath was the seventh day. I agree. The Sabbath was Saturday and is still Saturday for the Jews. And only the Jews were ever told to keep it. The Jewish religion, based on the Old Covenant, is to observe the Sabbath, because it says in the book of Exodus that the Sabbath was a sign between God and Israel of the covenant he had with them, which is made at Mount Sinai. The New Testament tells us there's a new covenant. And it says in Hebrews 8:13, where there's a new covenant, the old covenant is obsolete. It's like if both covenants were still in force, it'd be like a woman having two husbands at the same time. That's what Paul says in Romans 7, verses 1 through 4. We were married to the old covenant. We died with Christ. We now remarried Jesus, one who rose for the dead from the dead so we might bear fruit to God, Paul says. So we're not married to two covenants at the same time. We got one at a time. There was the old covenant. It's defunct. It's obsolete, the Bible says. And now there's a new covenant. So covenants are different from each other. I mean, they have things in common with Yeshua, but you say God doesn't change. Well, he changed his covenant. He didn't change himself. And, if we say he didn't change anything, in the law was part of the old covenant, then we have to deal with the fact that Hebrews chapter 7 and verse 12 says, since there is a change of the priesthood, because in chapter 7 of Hebrews we're being told there's a new priesthood, Christ is a priest after the order of Melchizedek, which means it's changed. It's no longer the order of Aaron as it was under the old covenant. It says in Hebrews 7:12, there being a change of the priesthood, there must of necessity have been a change of the law. Okay, so we're being told the law has changed. There's been a change of law. If you've got a different priesthood than the law recognized, then having a different priesthood would require a different law, a change in the law. Now, did God change? No, he doesn't change, but his law changed. Why? Because the old law was related to an older covenant. The new law is related to the new covenant. And you cannot have the new covenant and the old covenant at the same time. A woman can't marry a second husband and still keep her first husband. So we're really in a position to say things have changed. And we would know that anyway. I mean, think about this for a minute, Glenn. Do we offer animal sacrifices? Do we go to Jerusalem three times a year and observe these festivals and offer animal sacrifices on an altar? That's part of the law. It's required. The law required that. But we don't do that. Why? Because we're not under that law. We're under a new covenant. What about Sabbath keeping? That was commanded in the old covenant. In fact, it was the sign between God and Israel of that covenant. I don't relate to God in that covenant. I have a new covenant now, and the new covenant never mentioned the Sabbath. Jesus never mentioned keeping the Sabbath. It's interesting that when you look at the teaching of Jesus, all of the moral laws that were in the Old Testament pretty much get repeated in Jesus' teaching. One law that does not is Sabbath keeping. Jesus never commanded the Sabbath, never alluded to his people keeping it. And if anything, he got in more trouble with the Jews about that than anything else, because they were continually saying he was breaking the Sabbath. It's clear that Jesus was not communicating that we have to keep the Sabbath. There's no command to keep the Sabbath in the New Testament. And for that reason, I have no reason to believe it's part of the New Covenant. In fact, Paul indicated that Christians are free to keep it or not. If they want to, they can. In Romans 14, he said in the church there were Christians who wanted to keep one day special above others, and there were other Christians who wanted to keep all the days the same. And he said, well, everyone can do what they want to do with that. Let everyone be fully persuaded in his own mind. In other words, there's no obligation there to do one or the other. You're not obligated to keep the Sabbath. You're also not obligated to not keep the Sabbath. I know Christians who keep Sabbath, and that's fine if they want to rest one day a week. That's what keeping Sabbath means. So, the idea that we have to keep the Sabbath as a law to us mistakes the Old Covenant with the New Covenant. And I find that Seventh-day Adventists apparently don't have any idea of what the New Covenant is. I mean, I've debated very informed Seventh-day Adventists, And it seemed clear to me, like the idea of the new covenant is like never occurs to them. They have no idea what it means. So that's why I
please,
don't
can
hold
I ask
the
you
view.
Just one question, please?
I wish you would have earlier. Go ahead. I have other questions today, but do you really have a question?
Yes, my last question. My question is, why Jesus didn't say that us? Because in verse 20 said very clearly, but pray that you were
flight. That your flight will not be on the Sabbath. Yes. In Matthew 24, he said, pray that your flight will not be in the winter or on the Sabbath day. Why? Because when you flee from Jerusalem, as they had to do in A.D. 66, and that's what he's talking about. He's talking about before the Jerusalem was going to be taken over by the Romans. He's telling his people to flee from there. When they see Jerusalem surrounded by armies, they need to flee from Jerusalem and pray that it won't be in the wintertime or on the Sabbath. Well, why? Is there some law against fleeing on the wintertime? No. It's just very inconvenient to flee in the wintertime. Better to do it in good weather. It's also inconvenient if you're a Jew in Jerusalem to flee on the Sabbath. The gates might be shut. The shops will be closed. You can't buy food. You know, there's simply, what he says, pray that you won't be debarred from fleeing by inconvenient circumstances like winter or Sabbath in Jerusalem. Now, if he, let's just say, no, he meant it's wrong to flee on the Sabbath. Well, why would it be wrong to flee on the Sabbath? The Pharisees had a tradition that you're not allowed to travel more than 1 mile from your home on the Sabbath day. That distance was called a Sabbath day's journey. It is not in the law of Moses. The Ten Commandments don't contain it. The other laws of the Old Testament, there's not a word in the Old Testament law about a Sabbath day's journey. The law of Sabbath was you don't do any of your normal work on the Sabbath. The Pharisees and the rabbis, they made up traditions about what you could and could not do. Jesus did not follow those traditions. So even if, if he was saying, hey, it's wrong to flee on the Sabbath, pray that you don't have to do that, he'd be confirming that there's some law against traveling on the Sabbath. There was none. Only the Pharisees had that as a tradition. And Jesus did not agree with the Pharisees in their exaltation of tradition over the Word of God. Derek in Vancouver, B.C., welcome.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call there. I've really been considering the end times things, and I'm wondering what the eschatology of the early church was.
Well, I know what you mean. Of the various camps that dispute among themselves today over what the end time scenarios are, which one did the early church hold? Well, of course, if by the early church we mean in the book of Acts, we don't have any clear evidence given. And if there was, there wouldn't be disputes today because everybody who's an evangelical Christian today, no matter what view of the end times they have, they're convinced that that was what the apostles taught. If they thought the apostles taught something different, they would probably change and believe what they thought they taught. Every view thinks that the early church, meaning the apostolic church, took their view. And that's what's up to dispute. Now, if you mean the early church, meaning the church fathers, they did not write systematically about the end times. And when they did write about the end times, they didn't all agree with each other, just like modern authors who talk about it don't all agree with each other. Church fathers were known to think different things. Irenaeus, for example, believed that the Antichrist would rise up and draw all the Jews back to Israel to judge them there and would have them rebuild the temple. We don't have that taught in most of the church fathers. Several of the church fathers in the early days believed that Jesus would set up a 1,000-year kingdom, like the premillennial view today holds. But not all of them taught that. Justin Martyr taught that, but he said he knew many Christians who didn't teach that and didn't believe that. He didn't say what their names were. We don't have writings from all of them, but some Christians were premillennial, some were not. After the time of Origen, premillennialism tended to die out. By the time of Augustine, there weren't many premillennialists left in the church. More were amillennial. And it's very hard to read the church fathers and come up with some kind of a uniform eschatological system. And I think probably because it's a fool's errand to try to do so. I know people do it all the time, and they are on a fool's errand, I believe. The Bible talks about many eschatological things, but it nowhere puts them in some kind of a chronological order. And our minds naturally want to put things in order, so if we do so, we're speculating. And when different people do it, they're speculating differently. What we do know is there will be a last day. There's a day of the Lord that the Scripture speaks of. It's a day of judgment. It's a day of resurrection. It's a day when Christ will be seen by every eye. It's a day when there will be judgment on the earth and so forth. Now, those things are true, but the Bible doesn't give us like a, here's what happens first, here's second, here's third, here's fourth. And because it doesn't, people in old times, the church fathers, just like people in modern times, they came up with their own guesswork. We have to remember, when we talk about the church fathers, they're very august men, because they knew people who knew the apostles in some cases, or knew people who knew people who knew the apostles. They're very early, but they didn't all agree with each other. So it's impossible to use them as we would use Scripture, as if, okay, well, he said that, so that's the view of the church. No, that's his view. You consult a different church father, and he's got another one. So it's not possible to choose between the available eschatological systems by appeal to the church fathers, because they're all over the map. They simply don't speak with a united voice. I'm almost out of time. Let me talk to another caller if I can. Mike from Torrance, California. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I think mine will be quick, hopefully. I'm referencing John chapter 1:24, but I'm pretty sure I've seen it in other Gospels, as far as when the Pharisees are speaking to John the Baptist and asking him, you know, who is he? And they say, you're not the prophet, not Elijah, not the Christ. And there's other places. I'm just wondering, who is the prophet that early Jewish audience would have understood?
Right. They said, are you the Christ? He said, no. Are you Elijah? No. Are you the prophet? That prophet? No. And it's true, after Jesus fed the multitudes, they said, surely this is that prophet. What prophet? It's alluding to Deuteronomy chapter 18. Moses said, when I'm God, the Lord your God will raise up another prophet like me. And he said, whoever doesn't listen to that prophet will be cut off from the people. Now, the book of Deuteronomy ends by saying, since Moses died, there has never arisen a prophet like him. So the Jews had this idea, well, there's going to be this amazing prophet who's like Moses. Who's going to be raised up? I think some of them might have equated him with the Messiah, and some did not. The New Testament writers do associate him with the Messiah. In Acts chapter 3, Peter makes reference, actually quotes that passage in Deuteronomy 18. And Stephen does the same thing in Acts chapter 7. And they make it very clear that prophet is the same as the Messiah, who is Christ. But that's the Christian understanding, and I believe the correct one, obviously. But the Jews didn't have unanimity about that. I think some of them did think that prophet would be the Messiah, but it seems to me like a lot of them thought there'd be an additional person, the prophet that Moses predicted, and then also the Messiah, another person. That's what it seems like. The Jews didn't all share one opinion about things, just like the church fathers didn't. Makes it hard. But when they say that prophet, they're referring to the prophet that Moses spoke about in Deuteronomy 18:15 and 18:18. I'm out of time. I hope that's been helpful. You've been listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. We are listener supported. Our address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Our website is thenarrowpath.com. God bless.